Members, I got to call the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Finance Committee to order. And look for approval of the minutes. Somebody make a motion.
I will make that motion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Just like to make an announcement. You'll notice Jason Metz is not here today. They were blessed with a child yesterday. Little boy, Josiah. And at 9 hours old, he was talking.
Think about
not mining. Looks like Chief Financial Officer Julek is ready for her presentation. Is that correct?
Perfect.
All right, proceed.
All right, Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Barb Julek, and I'm the DNR Chief Financial Officer. We're continuing on page 9 of the presentation for those following along with the paper version. The governor recommends a biennial budget just under $1.1 billion for the DNR for the 18-19 biennium. This includes the $926 million in base funds that we discussed 2 weeks ago. In addition, it also includes $76 million in funding from the General Fund, Game and Fish Fund, and Natural Resources Fund, which equates to an 8% increase over that base budget. And then finally, it includes the continuation of legacy funding for Parks and Trails Legacy and Clean Water Legacy of $72 million, for a total new spending above the base of $148 million. In addition, the governor is recommending revenue changes totaling $40 million. The majority of these changes are based on proposed fees, which we will discuss as we go through each individual change page. As shown in the prior slide, the governor's budget is recommending $148 million above the base. This new spending can be broken down to three categories: restore, maintain, and invest. The first category on the top of the slide is the restore category. This includes a number of proposals that restore program capacity that has been lost over time due to rising costs or spending reductions we've had to take to meet the level of revenue that's available. This area accounts for 13% of the proposals, or just over $19 million, and 40 FTEs. And I just want to be clear that the FTEs represented here are current vacant FTEs that are not supported within our current budget. So these aren't brand new. These are just FTEs that we've had to keep vacant. The next category is maintain. This is the largest category of the budget. This represents 74% of our requests, or over $100 million. And these proposals are maintaining the current level of services we have today. This includes proposals that continue one-time funding, that proposals that recognize the impact of increased costs of doing business, and the legacy funds. The FTEs here represent currently funded positions that, without these proposals, we would need to reduce or find savings to meet that identified cost pressure. The last category reflects new or additional activities. This is 13% of the proposals, or again, just over $19 million for the 18-19 biennium. And the FTEs here, the 17 FTEs here, represents new FTEs to the agency, and this equates to about a 0.6% increase over the 16-17 FTEs. So from there, Mr. Chair, we will go into the individual budget proposals. So the first proposal requests $22.1 million for an operating adjustment relating to compensation, pensions, and information technology. About a third of this request is from the general fund, and the balance is from other funds, primarily game and fish and natural resources. This request represents 30% of the new spending, not including the legacy funds. Agencies' budgets are subject to inflationary pressures, whether it's on the personnel side, including compensation and health care, or on the non-personnel side, including information technology, supplies, or equipment. Recognizing these pressures, the governor is proposing across all agencies an operating adjustment for certain known increases and anticipated increases. Specifically for DNR, this includes $12.4 million for known compensation increases. These are based on currently agreed-upon contracts that reflect step increases for those who are eligible.
Ms. Pruitt, when are those negotiations taking place, the contracts?
Mr. Chair, I'm not part of those negotiations. I don't know, but this increase is currently agreed-upon contracts.
All right.
These are projected increases. So again, for the DNR, these current contracts are projected to increase the DNR compensation costs by 2%. And so that $12.4 million represents that known 2% increase. In addition, the governor also recommends a 1% adjustment for anticipated compensation growth, as well as for the employer share of pension. So these are anticipated costs. On the pension side, the Minnesota State Retirement System is proposing an increase to the employer share of the general plan from a 5.5% of payroll to 8% of payroll over the next 4 years.
We have a question.
Yep.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on the anticipated costs, is that anticipated at current, or is that anticipated with the new, with the 17 new FTEs?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be at current.
Follow up, Mr. Representative.
So what would be anticipated if you add, let me add the numbers that you have here, another $19 million, and then ongoing for the 17 on top of the $8
million? Ms. Buehler.
So, Mr. Chair, for those 17 new positions, is your question, would they, just want to make sure I understand.
My question is, you're anticipating an 8% or 1%, $8 million growth in anticipated for employee pension contributions and compensation growth. Do we add $19.5 million on top of that $8 million with the new 17 new?
Ms. Dulick.
Mr. Chair, the 17 new is fiscal noted to reflect the cost of known cost of adding those positions. The fiscal note did not include any anticipated pension costs for those new positions. And so you are correct, there is an interaction between these pages that would need to be looked at. Am I getting to your question? I'm not sure I am.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
We are anticipating $8 million increase. If we get 17 new FTEs, will that go up to close to $30
million? Ms. Julie?
That's what I'm asking you. Because it says here we're investing, on page 10, you're looking at, you said 17 new FTEs, and the number there, 18-19 is 19-419, correct?
Correct.
So if we get the 17 new employees, that's what it's going to cost us.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
And I guess I already have my answer that the $18 million then would be with the anticipated cost for current plus the 17, we're looking at about $30 million, pretty close.
Ms. Dulick.
So we are looking at 17 new positions and other activities within those proposals that would cost $19 million. It's not just position costs, but there would be 17 positions in those proposals. Under the $109 million, this $22 million is included as part of the maintaining current. So this would be maintaining current positions. This is part of the $109 million under the maintain bucket. If this proposal goes through, what the impact would be under the new positions is a good question, and there would be an impact, and we would need to manage through that.
Representative Ublin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on the $1.8 million in increased minute costs.
Yep.
Now, seems like virtually every agency is experiencing some significant minute costs. What are those costs going for, and how are those costs determined?
Mr. Lick. Yep, Mr. Chair, so this 1.8 represents about a 5% increase from fiscal 17 into fiscal 18 and then flatlined across the biennium. It represents Minute's estimate of their cost of providing services, a wide range of services from desktop support to network connections to enterprise software purchases. And it's their estimated cost and then their estimated DNR volume of need projected to what they think our budget, what they think the cost of our need will be in the 18-19 biennium.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, how do you know that these costs are competitive with the outside marketplace? Minute is a complete captive. They're essentially billing you or estimating what they want. How do you know these are real competitive costs if you went outside and had something bid?
Ms. Joy.
Mr. Chair, Minute does a comparative analysis, and I think they have one that they just recently completed, and I believe they will be presenting to the state government committees. But that recent analysis showed I'm not going to quote a number in case I quote it wrong, but it was a high significant or a high percentage of services are cost below, at or below other competitors.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Minute doesn't have any other competitors. Every state agency goes through Minute, and you mentioned that these are Minute's estimated costs for estimated services. Are you providing Minute the needs, or are they providing you just their costs?
Mr. Chair, so there is a within every agency, there is a Minute at agency staff. I work with our chief information officer, who's at our agency, who is a Minute employee, but is assigned to the DNR, and we review together the volume estimates, and we review together the DNR impact numbers. There's also a finance steering team comprised of a number of CFOs and CIOs that work with Minute to review the Minute's budget overall. We literally go line through their budget. Is it reasonable? Does it make sense? Do we agree with it? We did make a number of adjustments this year based on those conversations. So it's a very transparent process with the CFOs, and it's done in conjunction with the at-agency IT staff.
One final?
Representative Uglum.
Thank you. One final follow-up. Well, if you're looking at a 5% increase in Minute costs, and the agency is trying to save money, and I mean you're essentially flat in terms of many of the things that are going on in terms of fishing licenses, hunting licenses, things like that. I guess I fail to understand why a 5% increase is projected in the budget, but we will be reviewing Minute in the state of finance committee. And it seems like this is pervasive throughout all the agencies. Very big IT cost increases this year. Thank you.
Ms. Willick, I'm not sure that there was a question there, so I have another one I'm going to actually move. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the question I have is, again, dealing with Minute, because like we're saying, we're seeing this in every department, in every budget, huge increases for Minute costs. When you're working with the person from Minute in your department and trying to figure out costs, are you figuring out the costs of just the programs you have, or are programs you also including in those costs programs you'd like to start?
Ms. Julie.
Mr. Chair, this is continuing programs we have.
Looks like we can proceed with presentation.
All right, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out on the pension increases. I'm not sure if I mentioned the state patrol retirement plan, because we do have law enforcement officers within DNR. That plan is also proposed to increase over the next 4 years under the MSRS proposal with a 2.5% increase in 18 and 4.5% in 19. And if you were to look through your book, the actual change page is not in the DNR book. It's in whatever book carries the MSRS pages, but the cost is reflected in each agency's budget. So the cost is reflected here, but the actual change page is somewhere else. And then I just want to also note, you know, absent this funding, we would have to reduce activities. And just looking at the 2% known increases, that equates to about 96 positions. And then in addition, other than the IT request, any non-compensation inflation that we may see, such as inflation for supplies or equipment or in contracts, we will also need to be managing through the next biennium. And just as an example, a 1% year-over-year increase on inflation for any of these goods could equate to up to $8 million of costs that we would need to manage on top of these other known or anticipated costs. All right. Mr. Chair, the next proposal is a request for just under $7 million from the general fund for anticipated legal costs. Over the last 2 years, the DNR and PCA have received funding from the legislature for legal costs related to water activities and PolyMet. We expect increased activities over the next few months that will continue to spend these funds down. We also anticipate continued litigation issues with PolyMet over time as various decisions are made. Last year's request was partially funded, and we are coming back to request these additional funds for these challenges, as well as other cases on the horizon, such as Wiper Lake and Fargo Moorhead Diversion Project. Of the $7 million requested here, about $2.5 million is the PCA's request, and the balance would be the DNR's request. Right, Mr. Chair, the next set of proposals are relating to State Parks and Trails, so Director Rivers will come down.
Thank you very much for your presentation. And Director, introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, members. My name is Erica Rivers for the record. I'm Director of Minnesota State Parks and Trails.
Thank you. Proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, I would like to thank you this morning for an opportunity to present the Governor's budget request for the Division of Parks and Trails. As many of you know, 2016 was a big year for us here in Parks and Trails. We celebrated 125 years of what I consider, maybe a little bit biased, one of the best state park and trail systems in the nation. 50 years ago, we initiated the Casey Jones State Trail, one of the first rail trail projects in the nation, and our system has grown incredibly over the years. For both state parks, 75 state parks and recreation areas today, as well as 25 state trails. We had lots of celebrations and parties last year, and as you all know, anniversaries are also a really nice time to stop and take stock of where you're at. So what the past 125 years looked like and what we might be facing in the next 125 years as our system matures and turns into its next phase of operation. We're watching four trends as we look forward into the next generation of state park and trail use and management. One of the major trends that we're watching right now is the demographic shift in Minnesota and across the nation. As many of you are aware, the nation and Minnesota in particular have an aging population, and that has impacts on how we offer recreational services for the Division of Parks and Trails. We are seeing an aging population as well as a population that is changing its use of different kinds of outdoor recreation, going away from traditional resource or outdoor recreation pursuits and moving into to newer ones such as fat tire biking and paddle boarding, for example.
Director, I've noticed my neighbor who's 86 years old taking his Polaris side-by-side out almost every weekend, even through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
It's unbelievable.
It is true, and we are seeing, Mr. Chair, we are seeing a lot more folks with extra income and as well as free time on their hands out in our parks and trails. Very definitely, we're seeing an older demographic. We're also watching a second trend, which is an increasing understanding of the benefits of outdoor recreation. Quite frankly, our nation is witness to lots of health and wellness issues right now, from diabetes to increased anxiety and chronic disorders like hypertension. And there's an increasing recognition in a lot of empirical research at this point that shows outdoor recreation lifestyle is one that is a lot healthier. And so we are, in fact, seeing an uptrend in a lot of recreation in our parks and trails right now and associated pressure on those facilities as well. The third major trend we're watching, and you've heard this before as we've testified in this committee, and you'll hear more about through our Operations Services Division, we're also witnessing an aging system. Most of the Minnesota State Parks and Trails system, as well as the system nationally, was built in the 1930s or the 1960s, the two big booms in outdoor recreation development in our country. The consequence of this aging infrastructure is that we are seeing increased safety issues within these aging facilities, such as cracks and breaks in our trails, accessibility problems for facilities that were designed in the 1930s and the 1960s before accessibility standards were clear, and very troubling are actually some health concerns. Some of you will know that Blue Mountain State Park, for example, hasn't had potable water in 3 years due to an aging below-ground infrastructure. And then the final trend that we're watching very carefully is one probably most pressing to this committee today, and that's a trend of our budgets not keeping pace with the inflation and growth of our system over time. This has created a structural deficit in our budget that I will describe here today. This next slide really shows how much, as I mentioned, our increase in outdoor recreation activity we're seeing in our state park and trail system. Minnesota State Parks and Trails are very highly valued. As the commissioner testified last Thursday, we see about 1.1 million overnight visitors a year in our state parks, about 10 million visitors, day users, every single year. The graph here shows our daily and annual passes. I think there was a question from this committee about the increases that we've seen. This graph represents about a 30% increase in our daily and annual passes over the last 5 years. So we are seeing increased interest and engagement with state parks and trails. Particularly in Greater Minnesota, state parks and trails are a huge driver of economic impact and tourism. We see in Explore Minnesota Tourism's recent research in 2010 that Minnesota state parks represent 32 of the 50 top attractions in Greater Minnesota for tourism. And just last month, Minnesota Department of Transportation and University of Minnesota issued a study that indicated our biking industry generated something like $780 million of economic activity in 2014 alone. We brought about 50,000 visitors to our trails in 2014 through 100 different bicycle events, generating an additional $14 million of economic impact. And this is mostly economic impact in Greater Minnesota and rural communities. And I think it's also important to point out that our budget is also that goes through parks and trails supports a tremendous amount of local opportunities. Roughly 25% of the state parks and trails budget goes through pass-through grants to local communities for outdoor recreation facilities.
I'm just going to quickly interrupt. We have a question. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said 10 million visitors each year. Do you have a breakdown of that per park somewhere?
Ms. Rivers?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we do have a breakdown of that by park, and we can get that information to you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you. So as I mentioned, our parks and trails have grown in many ways over the course of our long and storied history. In recent years, we have seen quite an increase in both visitorship, as I just mentioned, but also in the size of our system. The graph you see here represents the number of paved trail miles over time. That's the bars on this chart, and our operating budget for maintaining those state trails being the line on this chart. But our system has grown just more than just trails. We've also added additional state park and recreation areas, and we manage a very big system at this point. The Division of Parks and Trails is really responsible for six major areas of operation. First, Minnesota state parks and recreation areas. Second, all of our state trails, paved and natural surface trails. Our forest recreation areas is a third area that we oversee and manage. These include both camping units as well as day use units like picnic areas and parking lots and trailheads. We manage the entire water recreation facilities for the state of Minnesota. You guys mostly will recognize the public water access sites that we oversee, but we also oversee the fishing piers as well as the boating and canoe routes. And then finally, we also oversee motorized recreation in the warm weather. Those are off-highway vehicle trails throughout the state of Minnesota, and at this time of year, it's snowmobiles.
Representative Ugo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, question about the paved trails in terms of maintenance, overlay, crack filling, and all these other things. A lot of the paved trails are relatively new, things like that. Do you foresee increasing deficit in terms of your ability to maintain blacktop trails?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, we do have an increasing need for ongoing maintenance and upgrade of those state trails. We presented some information and can a couple of years ago to this committee and can resubmit it to you about the estimated cost, but roughly $12 million a year would be needed just to maintain the existing system of trails, just for capital investment.
Follow-up, Representative.
And that's just for paved trails?
Yes, for the Director existing Rivers. Paved trails.
Wow. Okay, thank you.
Representative Beckerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a lot of information here about different FTEs, and I'm just wondering if you could, if you know, maybe someone else here knows, how many jobs are actually, you know, how many Minnesotans are we actually employing through the state parks and, you know, affiliated trails, and 75 state parks seems like a lot of jobs.
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the question. Yes, we do employ a great deal of people throughout the state of Minnesota. This time of year, we have around 400 full-time equivalents that are year-round permanent staff. When we're fully staffed up to provide public services to the citizens of Minnesota in the summer months, when most of them are out recreating in our system, we're fully staffed at around 1,200 FTEs. So, yes, we do run, that's 1,200 employees. So it is quite a large system to provide that level of public service.
Yeah. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rivers, you've broken out a number of different types of trails here, but you've not broken out any specific bicycle trails. Where do they fit? Do you have any idea how many you have currently, and can you tell me how much revenue is generated by the users of those trails?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair and members, we have roughly about 2,900 miles of authorized state trails, of which about 1,500, I believe, are currently developed. Only 600 of those miles are paved, so that's what you're seeing on this chart here. So that's the extent of the system to date. It's a developing system. It's not complete yet. As far as what kind of revenue is generated by bicycles, of course, or bike riders, of course, they pay income sales tax on all of the equipment that they use for their sports. Of course, not just bicyclists use our state trails. We also have people who walk their dogs and use strollers to be with their children. Minnesota state trails are developed to a standard where they are ADA accessible. And are supposed to provide a safe family experience. Recently, the Minnesota Parks and Trails Council did produce some interesting information about the usership. They anticipate about 1.8 million people use our state trails. We know, for example, that for state park visitation, each state park visitor generates approximately $25.51 per day in local communities in which they're visiting. So that kind of research has not been done on state trails at this point, but we could certainly do some kind of research like that.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about, of that trails inventory, how many are bicycle only?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not sure I can give you an answer to that today. But I can certainly get you more information about the breakdown. Most of our trails are multi-use.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that information.
Mm-hmm. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Rivers, for coming here and giving us this information today. This might be a question for for Ms. Julek. What funding source? The DNR operates and they maintain a significant amount of road mileage. What account does that road maintenance come from? Who pays for that in the DNR? Which pot of money does that come out of?
Mr. Chair, Representative, are you referring to roads within the state parks?
Representative?
Correct.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, the state parks would maintain their roads in one of two ways. If it was a major reinvestment, say a very aged road, we would seek capital investment for those kinds of repairs. General maintenance can be done in one of two ways. Either our parks staff, buildings and grounds, would help maintain those roads, you know, for example, mowing them and regrading them as necessary. The other option we use frequently in our state parks is to contract with other local units of government for that service, so plowing and maintenance.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one more time, I understand what they do. Which pot of money does it come out of?
Director.
Mr. Chair and Representatives, that would be from general fund and a state park account.
Representative. Looks like you can proceed, Director.
Thank you. So, members, just to recap or finalize this slide, we do represent or serve a very large set of constituencies within state parks and trails, given our six major levels of or broad areas of service. 10 million park visitors annually, 820,000 registered boat owners, about 500,000 ATV and snowmobile users, 20,000 cross-country skiers, and about 300,000 participants in our national programs in across the state.
Is there an estimate, did I miss it, of bicyclists that are users?
Mr. Chair, members, we don't have that estimate ourselves, but we have recent information, an estimate from the Parks and Trails Council that estimates 1.8 million.
Thank you.
Of course, you're welcome. So as
Representative Wagenius.
If she wants to finish, that'd be fine.
No, you have the floor.
I do have a question, though. Okay, I'll be fine. One of the things that, as we're getting questions here, is about going back to your demographics and the aging population. One of the underlying pieces of that is that in most of Minnesota, we are losing this youngest generation, the 20-somes. And it does seem to me that obviously, I don't think anybody at this table wants that to happen. So I'm wondering if you all are thinking of DNR as one of the attractions to keep that generation here, and how you might be specifically targeting those folks, as this is the great place to live and stay and work. And I just wondered if you had specific targeting for that particular demographic.
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, this is an issue near and dear to my heart, of course, so I could talk for quite some length on it. We are very concerned that the next generation is becoming disconnected from the outdoors, and as I mentioned earlier, we recognize that there are a great deal of benefits from a life that is spent outdoors. We like to say in our division that life is better outdoors. We are doing things in the Division of Parks and Trails to encourage the next generation to get involved with the outdoors. One of the chief programs that we have really promoted over the course of the last 5 years with the help of the legacy funds is our ICANN programs. And this was based on some research that we did back in 2008 that indicated that one of the chief barriers for outdoor recreation was actually that people lacked basic skills in outdoor recreation. And they didn't want to be embarrassed, frankly, in front of their kids by not knowing how to start a campfire or putting up a tent. And so we developed some programs to help them build those skills. And we have done a lot of very intentional marketing and outreach to young families in particular. We call them our target market. So most of our promotional materials are now targeted at young families for this very purpose, to try to get more people outdoors. We do a State Park Visitor Survey every 5 years. We are scheduled to do another one in 2017. The last one was in 2012. Back in 2012, I can tell you that the demographics of that survey exclude female. About 57% of our users were female. Only 3% were people of color. And so we have been working very hard to try to really encourage young families to be members of the outdoor recreation community. We're very anxious to redo the survey in 2017 to see if we're making some progress on that.
Thank you for the answer, Director. Proceed.
Thank you. So, as I mentioned, we're really seeing right now, because of the funding situation that we have had in the past several years, of probably about a decade, a growing gap between what our citizens are expecting of Minnesota State Parks and Trails and what we're actually able to deliver. State Parks and Trails are subject to very high operating costs that, because we require a high degree of staffing, facilities and grounds maintenance, fleet, and other basic costs of doing business like gas and utilities. My predecessor used to like to say that state parks, running state parks, is like running 75 small cities. Things that you, services you need to provide in those parks all over the state of Minnesota, are akin to running small cities. The consequence of the high, you know, is that some of these costs are really highly susceptible to inflation. And over the past several biennia, we have been sort of on an endless cycle of budget shortfalls and one-time funding fixes to plug the gap that we see in this inflationary costs. We've been doing this for more than a decade now. I know from many of you, because I've received your emails and your phone calls, that you, in fact, are getting calls from your constituents who are not accustomed to these cuts in services, as we've had to cut around the edges to meet our budget needs. About 5 years ago, Commissioner Landwehr asked us to really stop and take stock of where we're at with state parks, understanding that we couldn't simply provide all things for all people everywhere anymore. And he asked us to get together a blue ribbon committee, which is called the Future Strategies Committee, and they really indicated to us that we needed to look more strategically at how we delivered our services across the state park and trail system and be more disciplined in the niches that we would serve going into the future, so that our investments would be very targeted into the future, which is what we have been doing with our system plan, which was developed in 2015. As far as bridging this gap, the governor's proposal really makes two recommendations. One is to, and it's a combination of increasing modestly user fees as well as providing additional general fund appropriation. The general fund appropriation is largely to plug one-time funding gap of $6.9 million last biennium, and it includes a $3.7 million increase to cover increasing costs as we implement the system plan investments. We're also recommending modest user fee increases of about $5.3 million spread over 5 natural resource accounts. Many of these fees have not been raised in over a decade, and we believe in the state of Minnesota that there should be a combination of public monies as well as user fees to support our large system of parks and trails. CFO Julich presented a agency-wide view of this table here, and this is just to underscore for the Division of Parks and Trails, like that of the entire department, largely this budget request is to maintain and restore existing capacity. I'll point out that on this slide, there are 3 lines on here that are legacy funds. We do not consider legacy funds to be a core part of our operating budget. Those are value-added services and amenities that we provide in addition to our basic suite of services in our state parks and trails. You'll see from this that only about 3% of what we're proposing is an investment in new things. That's primarily in technologies in our parks, as well as some of the deferred maintenance that hasn't happened on trails. The rest of the budget is all for restoring and maintaining existing services and functions. In terms of the user fees, this chart really illustrates the problem that we have right now with the dedicated funding in our accounts with water recreation, snowmobile, all-terrain vehicles, and cross-country skiing. As I said, we haven't had a fee increase in most of these accounts in 10 to 14 years. the exception of that being the cross-country ski account, which we had an increase about 7 years ago. And these fees, I just can't emphasize enough, really are the basis of Minnesota's outdoor recreation system. And a lot of these opportunities, especially snowmobiling and all-terrain vehicle use, it is really the users of these systems that are supporting this through strong and solid partnerships with local counties and units of government to provide these outdoor recreation amenities.
Director, I see in the blue folder there is a budget in brief overview. Are we going to go to that at some point, or could I ask a question now?
Mr. Chair, certainly you can ask that question now.
Okay. We were talking about fees a moment ago, and I just noticed that in similar states, a comparison about the middle of the chart indicates that there are some systems, and there's similar states surveyed, and it includes a number of states. You wouldn't happen to know which state has a $235 state park permit fee, do you?
Mr. Chair, that would be California.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
So as long as you, Mr. Chair, if I may, as long as you have that chart out, this chart is a really nice summary.
Mr. Chair, for members looking for it, it's on your left side packet, and there's actually the two-sided, so the one side is the Fish and Wildlife, which we'll get to later, and then the back side is the Parks and Trails.
And so this, Mr. Chair, just as a reference to this, maybe you guys can all look through this a little bit later, but this is a nice summary of what our current fees are, what our proposed fees would be in 2017, what similar states are what I call comps would be across the country, what our current registration numbers are, and the estimated new revenue. So it's a nice summary of what the fees will do for the state of Minnesota.
I didn't mean to break up the presentation. I'm just curious if that might come into play at some point. Representative Neuberger. He left. Representative Johnson, Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director. A few minutes ago, you were talking about you've been in this long trail of about 10 years of kind of trying to catch up. And I've been on this committee for 4 years, and I've witnessed this committee really challenge the DNR on particularly on parks and trails, on you know, having to keep coming back and coming back. Mm-hmm. I really think it behooves us to get our state parks and trails on solid long-term footing and funding. What you're proposing here, can we then anticipate that you will be set, that you will be in a situation where you have that long-term funding that looking forward you can kind of normalize your operations?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair and members, so this gets to a point that I think CFO Julek was trying to make too, and it's a point that I can't emphasize strong enough. What we have is a structural problem here. The cost of doing business is going up, but I think you mentioned between 4 and 5%. And that's not just salaries on employees, but just the cost of doing business. Typically, we're seeing increases, in particular with the employee-associated costs that are about, 1.8%, I think, the last biennium. So we're simply not getting appropriated the funds that would get us to meeting that inflationary increase.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, to use your words are better than mine. Does this budget proposal get at that structural problem?
Director.
Mr. Chair and members, this will get at the problem for 2 years.
Thank you.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Chairman. I have a quick question. I'm looking at the accounts here, and we have user fees for ATVs, snowmobiles. Is there any planned user fees for bicycles? You mentioned a large number of bicyclists using these trails. They're expensive to maintain. Are we going to require a user fee for that?
Jack Rivers.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for that question. The user fee on state trails has been discussed at various times throughout the course of the history of this committee. There's only one other state that we're aware of in the union that does a trail pass. That's the state of Wisconsin. Our estimates on the kinds of revenue that a trail pass would bring in probably wouldn't solve the problem. and would create a great deal of administrative and enforcement issues that we would also have to fund using that trail pass. So the other thing I also would just like to reemphasize is that it's not just bicycles that use our state trails. We have walkers, people who walk their dogs, rollerbladers, horseback riders. Most of our trails are multi-use, so just putting a fee on bicycles probably wouldn't cover all of the different user groups that use those trails. But this is, I will acknowledge, a problem. We have a problem. There are other ideas that other states have used. They have Texas, for example, has actually dedicated some of their sales tax on outdoor recreation goods to sustaining their parks and trail systems. And I think it is time for us to do some really intentional research on what the best strategy would be for moving forward to fund these long term.
Director, just to be clear, you had mentioned those users that happen to be on horseback. They don't pay?
Mr. Chair, representatives, no, the equestrians do have a horse pass that goes into their horse account. And I don't have the numbers in front of me.
So that would be an example of a user group that doesn't pay.
They do pay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, remember, just for some background on this, when I first came here 15 years ago, I brought up this very subject that the bikers weren't paying for trails. And the DNR talked about we should do something about it. 5 years ago, I mentioned again, the DNR said we should study this. Last year, I asked our researcher, Ms. Taylor, to look into it, and she wrote a white paper on it as a short summary. And it's time to quit talking about it, really, and do something about it, because the bikers and so many people, it's an unfair system. Our snowmobilers and our ATVs are paying large fees to take care of their trails, and a lot of other groups aren't paying anything. It would be fairly simple, either some type of pass on your back or on your bike or some type of fee somehow, but it would generate a lot of the money that we seem to be short of. I think a reason is the bikers have such a big lobby and there's so many of them. Maybe they're just scared to do it, but I think it's time to quit talking and do an actual real in-depth study on it. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Rivers, if you would like to respond, you may. Otherwise, proceed. Oh, I apologize. If there is a answer you'd like to give, you may. Otherwise,
Mr. Chair and representatives, I do think it's also time to do some in-depth study on what the best path forward would be.
Representative Fisher, I apologize. I almost missed your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that bike fees get to be somewhat controversial. And one of the things I take a look at, we've got a state trail that goes through the middle of my district that is heavily used. A lot of the people that use it are people who are quite a bit younger. We've got a lot of kids who use it going back and forth from schools. I also know that a lot of people who are using it are people who don't have a lot of money. They can't afford their own cars, and so they're using bikes to get back and forth. And I know that the homeless youth population does a lot of traveling back and forth by bikes. And this is a population that is between the ages that we talk about of 16 to 26. This is the main way of getting around. And my pushback on the fees, if you're starting to look at fees, these are people who already don't have any money themselves, and this is just another way for them to suffer a penalty that makes it much harder for them to become involved in society, because I have found over the years that with the homeless youth population I've worked with, that it's because they've got nowhere to go. At certain points when it gets cold, they end up getting hit with trespass fees as they're trying to find a warm place to sleep overnight in an apartment building or something like that, and which then makes it tougher for them to get housing down the road. I also seen places where if you start putting fees on them, that's another thing that they're not able to pay, and that becomes another drag on where they go in the future. And I think that's one of the things that we have to keep in mind is as you're taking a look at it, where are the trails and who are the people that are serving it? Because I hate to see another barrier added on for some of the groups that are out there using it for their transportation needs.
Representative Fisher, before Director Rivers responds, I just quickly mention I live on the Paul Bunyan Trail. That actually splits my property. And it is amazing the equipment that passes through there. And a friend of mine specifically is riding something that just is a completely carbon fiber bicycle. And I understand there's just many user groups that don't have these kinds of resources. But this particular bike is $15,000. And you'd think that at some level there can be some consensus that might come and we might be able to figure out a way to target those folks that are heavily using these facilities, these resources, without participating. So, Director.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I think the representatives' points are well taken, and exactly the reason why we shouldn't rush into a trail pass. And I do respect the Representative Cornish's frustration that we have been talking about this for a long time, but that's why I think it is important that we do some significant analysis. A trail pass may not be the way to generate funds to do this. There may be other ways to do that. The other trouble with a trail pass, as you mentioned, we have a lot of state trails in the state of Minnesota. Some of them are state trails. 25 of them are state trails. But hundreds and thousands of miles of them are not state trails. And frequently when folks are riding on them, they don't know if they're on a state trail or a regional trail. So there are just a number of levels of problems with a strict trail pass that just need to be thought through, and there might be other strategies that would be equally appropriate. And I would also say that, I am very proud, I think we all are, of Minnesota's fantastic system of Minnesota state parks and trails. We have a long and storied tradition in the nation. I circulate with a lot of state park and trail directors across the nation, and they're very envious of the system we've established here. And that system was established on the notion, as you point out, of being a public good that Minnesotans are very proud of. They are some of the most special places in our nation, in our state. And so it's important that we provide access to those in a way that is low fee or no fee, in a way that our system has been set up throughout our history.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you brought up the interesting question of do we know what the sales tax is on bicycle equipment? I know the Department of Revenue can break down sales tax quite well, but I don't know if they can get at that specific. And it would be interesting if we could find out, one, can they break it down well? And two, what we might see as a number or numbers. Or do we need to ask them to break it down because they've never thought that they needed to do it? So maybe we can get at that question that way.
Sounds like that's something that CFO Julek might be able to collect at a later time.
But Mr. Chair, I see that she is taking notes here.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think there have been some bills introduced for the stroll toll. Are we going to be hearing those, or is that coming in front of this committee for that toll on strolling that I think we're talking about here? So we can have public input on that, and maybe on the bike fees or the back fee, I guess, to put the pass on the back. So just looking forward to that debate.
Representative Hansen, if I remain chair, I will go ahead and have that conversation. I can't speak for the chair. I missed the follow-up question, Representative Wagenius. Go ahead.
Actually, the question I put on the table was not the one I was pursuing. I'm sitting here thinking about this youngest demographic again and some of the remarks you made. So one of the things that one of my basic questions is, if we are going to appeal to that demographic, are we looking at some of our regional centers, Alexandria or Bemidji or Worthington, whatever, and to see if people who live in those regional centers can actually get out into the DNR system on trails? So do the trails in Worthington connect up with the trails, DNR trails around Worthington, or similarly in New Ulm? Do the trails in New Ulm, do they connect? Because in that, if they did, we could advertise that to this demographic that we need to encourage. And if they don't, maybe we need to think about that.
Director Rivers, looks like we lost the vice chair on that question. So
did he fall asleep?
Yeah, he did.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm sorry that the vice chair is asleep. Cute little three-year-old over there. To answer Representative Wagenius's question, yes, absolutely, we're thinking about how to create connections between local communities and local trails and state trails. There is a really great project that's being funded with the legacy dollars, which I can speak to in the legacy committee. That uses the state IT infrastructure, sort of the scaffolding on which all of the data is being collected from Greater Minnesota Metropolitan Council as well as DNR, state assets, and putting it into one user-friendly web interface that will allow people to make those connections and understand where those connections already are, as well as where they need to be. One of the great projects that I'm very excited about right now that is being funded through Legacy is a trail that goes from New London Spicer into Sibley State Park. This is an extension. It's not a state trail. It's an extension that connects the local community, both the state trail as well as the state park. And it's projects like this that I think are funded, that are the true legacies that this generation will leave for the next generation, connecting communities to these great state assets.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just more of a comment, and we can talk after, but I truly think, as the youngest person on this committee, if we're going to increase the users and thus the user fees, we're going to have to bring more of those populations to the table, and at least thus far, I'm not necessarily seeing that, and so I think that's probably an area where we really, the department could improve upon in bringing people from the younger generation and people of color to the table if we truly want to increase those user fees and increase those dollars.
Representative Johnson Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director, I want to, you know, I was asking about the structural challenge you have. I failed to ask the question, which may be even more meaningful. What if we don't do this? What would be the impact on state parks and trails if we do not adopt the governor's proposal?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair and members, the short answer to that is that without the governor's recommendation, we'll continue to see additional cuts in services from Minnesota state parks and trails, less frequency and maintenance of various facilities, trails, bathrooms, visitor centers, probably additional cuts to customer service within the parks. We're proud that we were able to implement a self-service option for a lot of our state parks, 100% reservable campsites that have actually allowed us to take 30,000 hours of sort of behind-the-desk kinds of services and reallocate those to in-park services like facility maintenance over the course of the last year. But we will continue to see an erosion of public services without the governor's recommendation. There just simply isn't the funding to provide all those services that we currently provide.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. As long as we're afforded some comments, the impact of that is significant where I live, where the number one challenge for ever since I've served, in, according to Greater Mankato Growth, is attracting talent to an increasingly challenged marketplace. And I think about the role of the state park and the state trails near my community to attract and keep that young people there is very significant. And I don't think the situation is limited to Mankato, but this is a statewide problem. It's also a rural issue because most of our state parks and trails are in the countryside. And so it's an asset that we have in rural Minnesota that gives us a slightly different angle than the Twin Cities may have. And we're always inevitably competing for the economic growth with this wonderful economic engine we call the Twin Cities. And so it's a tremendous asset in rural Minnesota. And so I think those comments are well taken. Thank you for the liberty.
To that point, Representative, I was amazed to hear just recently that the Cayuta rec area announced that they've raised almost $750,000 privately to build out some of their trail system. It's amazing how sometimes user groups can come together. Director, I also have a question along those lines. The point was raised earlier, looking down the road. Thank you, Representative.
there was the hope that this proposal from the governor's office would have a long-term effect, and you had mentioned that it actually would fund the systems for the next 2 years. Is there a reason we're not looking at some of the more long-term solutions, like perhaps doing something with license fees on bicycles or some other more long-term fixes?
Mr. Chair, members, one aspect of the answer to that question is just annual inflation costs. So as this year we have our operating adjustment page asking for an adjustment for known increases, I would expect every 2 years to continue to ask for that. And to the extent that gets funded at a level that meets our needs, then that would meet our needs. But then you always have that continual look at rising costs over your budget, and how do you manage that? And so that's part of the answer for that.
So, Mr. Chair?
Sure, Director.
Go ahead if you have another follow-up with for.
I was going to ask, is more to the point, is there any reason that we don't see the agency or the governor's office specifically proposing some more long-term solutions to those kinds of issues, so we're not constantly coming back year after year after year talking about kind of the same issue?
And, Mr. Chair, this is an issue that affects all agencies and all programs, so that particular issue isn't just for Parks and Trails. It's really how every agency needs to look at operating their budget and how they address increasing costs that occur year after year after year. We've traditionally in the budget done it through an operating adjustment request. I'm not sure other alternatives have been looked at. It'd be something interesting to talk with the lead fiscal analyst in the House and the Senate and with MMB on what some options there are.
I appreciate that answer. And to the point, agency or unit of government, I would mention here again, I'm very proud of my own hometown, Crow Wing County, hasn't raised the levy in 7 years. Proceed, Director.
Mr. Chair, members, just a further to your point, I think one of the reasons the governor's office, as well as the legislature, hasn't perhaps explored some of those real, new sources of revenue is because there's a recognition that parks and trails provide a real public good, and there's a feeling that we ought to support that public good with public resources like general funds. And I would just, to your point about Cuyuna, let you know that there have been some conversation here in the committee about operating losses. And I will just note on Cuyuna, for example, you look at the operating revenues that are come into Cuyuna and operating expenditures, there's a net loss of about $175,000 a year at Cuyuna. But then when I look at the revenue numbers, as I mentioned, $25.51 per person per day spent in local communities, that's outside the park boundaries expenditures, Cuyuna brings in about $4.4 million to the towns of Crosby and those around. So for a $175,000 investment on the state's part, local communities recognize about $4.4 million in local revenues to their local communities. We make these investments in the public good, and there are added benefits, not just for the health and well-being of the citizens of Minnesota, but also for the local communities in which these facilities and units are located, and the people that we employ in greater Minnesota as well. Further to Representative Clark's question as well, Clark Johnson's question as well, I just would also indicate that these special or these natural resource revenue accounts, these accounts for water recreation, they're up on the screen still, water recreation, snowmobiling, cross-country skiing, these accounts cannot go red, and that's where all these lines are going. With the fee increases, you'll see that I think it's a blue line or a red line on the, it's a red line, a dotted line on there. It's estimated where those fees or where those accounts would go if the revenues were gained. The impacts of those accounts not getting user fees at this point is cuts in grant and aid programs, for example, to local communities, as well as cuts in the programs that the state offers as well on the state trails systems that these accounts support. So
Just a follow-up to Representative Johnson's inquiry about what would happen without these increases.
Director, it sounded like you had some of those facts and figures in terms of profit and loss readily available. It would be nice maybe if our CFO could provide that throughout the entire trail system to my office. I'd appreciate that. Sounds like we had a question, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to pick up on the conversation about inflation. And this is a question from Ms. Ulick. When you do your budget and your budget proposals, are you looking at inflation?
Correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, when we set our budget, we look at projected costs, first in compensation, and that's where that 2% known increase comes in. And so we must account for that known increase coming into the budget. And again, as you recall from two weeks ago, we are dealing with a baseline amount of $926 million. So of that amount, which is a set capped amount that we put into the base, we have to account for that known projected increase. Anything unknown, such as the governor's request for the anticipated increases, are left to change pages. And so for that known increase, we do have to account for it. And so the way agencies account for it is removing positions from the budget or removing activities from the budget, one or the other, and then come back with a change page requesting it back. And so that's where that 18 comes in on that operating adjustment. And so in order to account for that increased cost, that known increased cost, we've accounted for it by reducing activities and positions in our budget. And then we are coming back and asking for it back in a change page.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you. And then do you also look at inflation with respect, for instance, buying vehicles or other items that you purchase?
Mr. Chair, we do look at that, and again, it's all within a capped dollar amount. Mm-hmm. And to the extent we know it's a known increase, then we can come in and request a change.
Thank you,
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Rivers, for your thoughtful presentation so far. I guess we're kind of talking a little about some of these reductions, perhaps in the abstract. I guess it would be helpful to know, and when you look at the water recreation account and snowmobile ATV. Cross-country, what are some, maybe an example or two that you could give us of where regular Minnesotans who use these parks and trails, what are some things they would likely feel or see if we don't fund these programs to the level that the governor is requesting or that you feel would be sufficient? What are some things that one would likely see, this summer or fall when they or next winter when they go into a state park expecting something?
Director River.
Mr. Chair and representatives, I think the calls you'll be getting in your office will likely be related to reductions in services. So very specifically, if the snowmobile account needs to be cut, there will be additional reductions to our grant and aid snowmobile system. There are already, in order to maintain the budget, above the zero line in the previous biennium, we have already held back about $1 million a year from the grant and aid programs for snowmobile. Your snowmobile clubs across the state of Minnesota have probably already called some of you about those reductions. They are starting to feel the strain of not having those operating dollars to operate the snowmobile system, for example. The state of Minnesota provides a lot of connecting trails for snowmobiles, and without the fee increase for snowmobiles, we will not be able to groom those ski trails or those snowmobile trails at the level they've been groomed in the past, or not at all in some cases. In terms of the water recreation, another very serious account going deeply into the red very quickly. What you will see there, and you'll get phone calls from, is the dock at the local public water access site is 4 feet too high right now. We will not have staff or operating hours to send out staff to adjust those docks at the frequency that we have. And as you know, in the state of Minnesota, our weather is varied, and our very dedicated trail staff go out on a weekly basis and adjust those docks up and down so that they meet ADA accessibility requirements so that anglers and boaters can get in and out of their boats. Those are the kinds of things that you will likely see if these fee increases don't go through or if the general fund request is met.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to hold questions till the end here and try to get through to the end of the director's presentation. Otherwise, we're going to miss out on enforcement today, so we're going to try to get through a little bit.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just have one last slide, and this is more of an informational piece for you. This is every year the State Parks and Trails Division also makes three change item requests regarding legacy funds for the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund, and we'll go into some depth of this, obviously, in the Legacy Committee on Monday. But we really focus those funds on four different pillars that are set forth in the Parks and Trails 25-year Parks and Trails Legacy Plan. And this chart shows a breakdown of the percentages that we propose for the 18-19 biennium. This, again, will follow the agreement that was made about two biennia ago for three biennia, which is a 40-40-20 split between State Parks, Metropolitan Council, and the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails Commission for the Parks and Trails portion of the Legacy Fund. We are proposing and are supported by the Legacy Advisory Council relatively maintaining the same proportions of projects in each of these pillars as we have in previous years. And with that, that concludes my presentation.
All right. I would remind members we're going to try and get to the next presentation. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one quick question, Director, going back to the snowmobile account. Mm-hmm. So if you get south of Cloquet, there isn't much snow. Is there a way to move funds around from one area to another where there's grooming going on or not going on during the winter?
Director Rivers.
Mr. Chair, members, for the state funds, yes, we do move funds around between our area offices to accommodate snow conditions throughout the state of Minnesota. This past weekend, we had great snow up in Grand Rapids, where the MinUSA held their annual event. As far as the grant and aid, those are set by a formula that was negotiated many years ago with the MinUSA snowmobile clubs. As I mentioned, literally hundreds of thousands of people across the state of Minnesota that volunteer their time and effort with some state support and funding in the grant and aid program to maintain the largest snowmobile system in the country, 21,000 miles of it. So those funds that go out through the grant and aid system are determined by formulas that were agreed upon by the clubs.
Representative Johnson B.
Mr. Chair, you talked about the revenue in the funds going down. But what I'm wondering is if the revenue in those funds that they're coming in is increasing or going down, or is just the expenditures going higher than the revenue coming in?
Director.
Mr. Chair and members, that will depend on the fund as to whether or not the revenues are going up and down. For example, a lot of our funds, especially these dedicated accounts, are highly weather dependent. You have a nice spring and summer, you have lots of revenue in the state park revenue account because more people are camping and buying park passes. If you have a low snow winter, not many people are registering their snowmobile sleds. They're sitting in inside the shed in the backyard, and they're not being registered. So we have a lot of inconsistency, in particular in the snowmobile account, where the revenues will really be highly fluctuating, dependent on weather. So I guess I would have to go account by account, or have CFO Julek, he could provide some information on that for you. The lines that you're seeing on this previous slide are actually the fund balances. And so it's the fund balances that are going into the red. And as CFO Julek has mentioned, there are really two factors in this. One is the growth of the system, and the second is the growth in inflationary costs of doing business.
Representative Johnson.
Well, thank you. I'd like to see that information as well, but I'm really curious how it goes up and down when the boat and the snowmobile and the ATV and all those registrations are multi-year licenses, so I don't believe just 1 year would have that much of an effect.
With that, thank you, Director. Very much appreciate your presentation. And thank you, Chief Financial Officer Julek. Appreciate that. And Colonel Rodman Smith. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, may I start?
You may.
All right. Mr. Chair, members, the Division of Enforcement employs about 206 licensed peace officers when we're at full strength. We're the primary conservation law enforcement agency in the state of Minnesota. I guess to be blunt, we're the boots on the ground. We're the people that are very visible to the public. We get a lot of questions. We have hundreds and in the fall thousands of face-to-face interactions with people on a daily basis. We get a number of calls for service that we either can take care of ourselves, or a lot of times we're the entry point into the Department of Natural Resources. People that want to do something with their shoreline, they don't know, I mean, the average person doesn't know what to do, they'll call the conservation officer. Conservation officer will then get them in touch with the hydrologist, whoever they need to, and get the permits that they need. So really what we do is a lot of public outreach. We have about 1,300 events a year that we average, where we get in front of groups of people and do talks, Lions clubs, different types of other activities. We have a safety education component where we certify about over 40,000 students every year in some type of safety education, whether it's firearm safety, snowmobile safety, ATV safety, boating safety. We work with 7,000 volunteers to do that. So we do a lot of outreach, and we do a lot of safety education. We're also the people that have to tell people no, that they're doing something wrong, and that we issue them citations sometimes. And unfortunately, that's sometimes what we're known for, is the people, the bad guys that write the citations. But we do so much more than that. We do a lot of search and rescue. We work closely with our partners in local law enforcement, tribal sheriff's offices, local PDs, some federal folks, but we do a lot of outreach. We're the extroverts, I guess, of the DNR that do a lot of work with other individuals. So our role over the years, first of all, what we do really is vital to the economic drivers of this state, the quality of life, and the heritage that we have in this state when it comes to our expanding roles in a lot of other areas. So, for example, getting into working with groundwater protection, that's something we never did in the 1950s and before. Wetlands conservation protection, a lot of other things. So a lot of commercial work that we do as well. So we're currently at 20 vacancies today. We'll be to 21 here on the 21st of February. We'll be to 23 April 4th, and 24, I believe, by May 1st of this year. So we're having retirements. And our budget is pretty simple. We have some dollars that pass through to counties for some grant purposes. We have grants that, money that passes through to some clubs like ATV ambassador programs that we work with to help with the trails. But really, our dollars go to putting the boots on the ground in the field, and the dollars that it takes to support those boots on the ground. So when we're hit with increases in compensation, retirement, when we're hit with increases in fleet, like a 1% fleet increase to me is about $400,000. I don't have a lot of room to find those dollars. So what I have to do is I have to leverage my vacancies, the vacant stations that I have, to pay for those increased operating costs. So Ms. Julep did a very good job talking broadly about those increased operating costs. So I'm asked, why do you have so many vacancies? It's because I'm leveraging those vacancies to pay for those operating increases, because I really don't have any other money to find a spender to fill those. So we currently do have about the same number of conservation officers we had in the 50s, but our job has changed immensely. The population's changed immensely. I think we have a fair number more fishermen in the state, people that hunt in the state. Our duties have broadened. We have a lot more opportunity. You can pretty much hunt something year-round in the state now with spring turkey, fall turkey. We have goose management seasons that start in August, where we're trying to help control goose populations. So our folks are busy. There really isn't a quiet time anymore. So what have we done to implement some reductions and some efficiencies? We do. We just went through about a two-year process where we developed a 10-year strategic plan, and I talked about it a little bit last year. We've looked at our structure, and we've actually reduced some of the specialty positions that were licensed. We've got 211 licensed. We've reduced that down to about 206 right now. We've spread out some of that specialty work. We've looked at things that we can have civilians do rather than a licensed peace officer. We rearranged some of our management structuring a little bit, but we're doing what we can within that frame that we have. We've looked at our staffing and how we respond to calls, looked at efficiencies in our fleet programs and other things. I think that's about it. I'll go to the next slide.
Actually, if you'd hang on for a second. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and members, everybody has a kind of a favorite spot in certain budgets. This is one of mine because I was a CO for 23 years, so, and they might come and get me down for a constituent thing, so I just wanted to ask a couple of questions first. First, I wanted to make the committee aware that I'm going to sound like Representative Carlson and Tom here talking about the old days. I'm sorry, but 31 years ago, I was in this room or one just like it, and this very same slide was up used by enforcement. Almost the exact words right here, number of current field officers similar to number in 1950s. I was down with a member of our association asking for more money for conservation officers, and they had about the same number in the field that they do right now. And we dribbled them a few more officers and a few more at each time. And just to give you a comparison, the state patrol has got 400 or 500 officers, and they do state roads and county roads. The game wardens are responsible for every lake, every trail, snowmobile trail, other trails, just in the whole state, and they've got the same number of officers that they did in the 50s. So this would be a soft spot to me in the budget where I would like to do something. But there's been a problem in the past where we give the DNR enforcement money. I want to give the colonel a chance to explain why the misestimation or why we didn't hire as many COs and go into a little more detail than what we wanted to the last finding. What happened to your budget or what didn't you foresee?
Colonel Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish. Mr. Chair, you know, I touched on it briefly, but if we want to get into a little bit more detail, you know, last biennium we were able to ask through the governor's recommendation for 9 positions. I think we were sitting at about 20 vacancies at that time as well. The legislature did fund those 9 positions for us, and we're appreciative of it. But these uncontrolled costs that I kind of touched on a little bit kind of crept in. A 1% increase in my fleet, that's $400,000. If you figure about $120,000 a year for an employee, you can see where you start have to looking at vacancies. We were able to ask and received, and it was appreciated, a 1.8% across the board increase for cost of living adjustment through the governor's proposal, and there was actually a 2.5% cost of living increase across the board, the pattern bargaining for all state employees. So you can see at 2.5% versus 1.8%, I mean, there was a deficit there. We had a number of other issues, and I think Minute was already talked about a little bit, not to bring that up, but I mean, just that cost of service, the inflation that came up, our base budget went through. We did get that 1.8%, very appreciative of it, but I wasn't able to keep up with the inflation. Did anything you want to add?
Representative Cornish.
You know, just to follow up, if I have to go before it's done, even if we gave them 21 officers, just keep in mind that our committee that we're bringing them up to 1950s levels, and now, since I was here then, they're probably to have at least 10 times the duties. I mean, boat and water and snowmobile safety and classes and wetland protection and environment, plus their full-time licensed officers that assist other agencies. And so with all these added duties, I think it, just do the best we can anyway on the subject. So thank you.
Colonel Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're up to an important. Just to move along, this slide was similar to what you saw in Parks and Trails and Ms. Julek. talked about it a little bit, and I'm going to start in the middle. In the middle is the maintain. So again, we talked about the increased operating costs. Ms. Dulick talked about agency-wide what those numbers were. So this maintain, this 3.258, this would be for my maintain, to maintain services. If I don't get these services, or if I don't get this funding increase, it will be probably looking at layoffs, to be quite honest with you, because 3.2, that's a big chunk of number. I usually run about 2 to 3% turn back on my budget at the end of the year. I operate on a very razor thin margin. The way it is, it gives a lot of us gray hair how close I come sometimes towards the end of the fiscal year. You know, and 2%, 1% isn't much. It's less than one last year. So, that's my portion of the maintain. The restore is what we talked a little bit about getting back to that full complement, and that's on that top level, that 5.57. So, on the bottom, real quick, the invest. That is something I'll talk about in my last slide, and that has to do with a proposal we have for ginseng, and I'll get into that a little bit. So, again, the delivery of natural resources, there's basically the three asks. This first ask is that restore, and it's about $5.5 million. It is a general fund ask. It's not something that's going to be on the backs of the accounts. So, I can go through this again, but I think we kind of talked about it at length here a little bit in the interest of time moving here. But, you know, increase compliance rates, calls for service, improve protection environment, natural resources. You know, the average officer has about 650 square miles in their station. With 20 vacancies, that's about 13,000 square miles. I believe that's about the size of Massachusetts and Rhode Island combined. That doesn't have the level of service that it could. So that's the delivery of natural resources. This next ask is budget neutral, which probably doesn't happen very often in these bills. But this is what's called funding flexibility. And there's great conversation and questions around this with Director Rivers about the snowmobile account. So, and I apologize if this is a little remedial, but so the Natural Resource Fund has several accounts in it. The ATV account, based on ATV registration and unrefunded gas tax, ATV, snowmobile, water rack, parks, off-highway motorcycle, off-road vehicle, all the fun stuff that are based on registration is in that natural resource fund. Traditionally, I'm allocated dollars for my operation costs from each one of those accounts, okay? And for fund integrity, I have to spend that money on that activity. So if I get $1 million in snowmobile money, I have to spend back $1 million on snowmobile activity. Hours, vehicles, whatnot, that are back and forth. The problem with that one-to-one ratio, and when I run over, I have to go into my general fund, which is pretty small. It was reduced quite a bit, like a lot of general funds were during the recession back in about 2008, which a lot of us want to try to forget about. But so what makes it difficult is when we have a high snow year, for example. We have snow early, snow statewide. People are out recreating on their snowmobiles. My officers are responding to that public need, to that public user group, and they're out there working more snowmobile hours. I can burn through our snowmobile budget very fast. On the reverse end, when there's high snow years, I usually don't spend as much money on ATV. People are going to recreate in the state. They're going to be out either on an ATV or a snowmobile. When there's low snow years like this in the southern part of the state, we're burning through a lot of our ATV money in the southern part of the state. So a lot of these activities, and this is just one example, a lot of these activities in these accounts are user-driven, and it's user-driven based on weather. So what this proposal would do is, instead of being locked into that one-for-one ratio of I have to spend $1 million on a snowmobile, because I got $1 million, or I have to spend $1 million on ATV because I got $1 million from the ATV account, the appropriations that are appropriated to me, or to the division, would go into an enforcement account underneath the Natural Resource Fund, and then I'd be able to spend from that account. And that would help with these ups and downs. Now, if you look at it, and we would still report back the number of hours we worked on certain activities. We'd still track all the stuff like we currently do. We'd be able to report that back. But over time, you know, the first year, if we look at it in a snapshot, it's not going to be fair because there might be a high snow year and the snowmobilers might get more work than the ATVers, you know. But over time, like a five-year, seven-year trend, it'll average out where we're working to where the need is rather than working to where the funding is. And that's kind of that funding flexibility in a nutshell. And it's just for those Natural Resource Fund accounts.
Chair Kimmel, isn't it still true that you have some type that used to be called the Deer's Report or something like that, where you have a code for each officer in each activity, so you'd be able to dial up an officer, say, up in Black Duck and find out how many hours he worked on small game, large game, snowmobiles. So you've got a pretty effective tracking system where these hours go. That's right.
Mr. Smith, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quirinches, thank you for that question. We do track every hour. So every hour that an officer works, they code to an activity. So they will still code to snowmobile. It's just the back end accounting of it would take the money out of this enforcement fund instead of coming right from the snowmobile fund. So the activity would still be tracked based on what the officers put in their timesheets like they currently do. It's just that the back-end accounting piece of it would be a little bit more flexible to account for. Really, what it comes down to is do we want our officers work user-driven, or do we want our officers work driven by fund in what we're appropriating? And so part of our strategic plan and part of this planning process was how can we better serve the citizens in the state? We need to be out there based on user activity. And it might give everybody, user groups, the legislature, a better idea of what's really out there, where the activity really is, and we can probably take a look at it here in about 5-6 years. We have good data to look back at and see where the work really is at.
Representative Cornish, follow up?
No.
Thank you. Representative Malik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Colonel. Something that I run into periodically, and I don't want to get too specific, but seems like we end up with a circumstance where a citizen calls into the DNR about wildlife damage, whether it be deer, geese, or you can just name beaver, goes on and on. So out comes the local biologist to talk to the citizen, and more often than not, eventually one of your folks goes out there, sometimes literally the referee, because the first answer from the biologist, I think it was more of a communication issue. But I'm just wondering, how much time do you spend in that particular area, and what role do the biology folks play in this? And I'm talking about situations where somebody's got an issue with geese damage that's threatening their livestock, or people are looking at knee-deep water in their front yard with beaver dams, and it just seems like if one person could go out there and solve the problem, it would save everybody a lot of time. And I don't know, maybe that's just an isolated circumstance in my area, but I see that fairly regularly, and it just rotates through the season. It's beaver, it's geese, it's deer, kind of a seasonal thing, but can you talk a little more detail about that relationship between the rest of the DNR and what you guys do?
Director Smith, do you? You're not going to tell me that you key in refereeing hours for your COs, are you?
Mr. Chair, we don't have that particular code. It might be wildlife, big game, small game. Mr. Chair, Representative Lewick, nuisance animals or nuisance wildlife complaints are very difficult, and when it comes to depredation issues, they can be filled with emotion. You're looking at people that have a livelihood. They're hardworking farmers. or they own a golf course, or they just own a piece of property that they put a lot of time into and have a lot of pride in. And so the state does have a number of depredation programs. They're pretty rock solid in what the elements of those are to be paid. And so, and you know, so, and sometimes you have to determine whether or not there actually was a loss based on wildlife. And so, depending on the situation, we do have to get called into referee, because sometimes people don't like the answer that they get. And, you know, sometimes people from the get-go who have maybe had a lot of problems with wildlife, nuisance wildlife issues or depredation issues, their first phone call is a little elevated. And the biologist might want to have a friendly face with them when they go out to see them. But, so we do some of it. Normally we don't have to do a lot of it, but we do get into it to that type of work.
Representative Luick, I understand, in fact, that where there's circumstances where, particularly where there's compensation in just a few of the programs, that, frankly, that seems to be working pretty well. Where I scratch my head sometimes are those that are really tough. Who owns the geese, for example, and how long does it take to develop a circumstance where the beaver dam is out? And more important, the beaver are gone, because they'll put the dam back very quickly. And those are areas where I just wondered about that time management thing, how often you know, you end up going out there at some point after, or even with, you know, you know, send two people to do a job to be sure. I guess we just got to look at that some more, and maybe that's just unique. We got way more water than we need in Aiken County most of the time, and way more beaver than we need done most years. So, but yeah, if we could take a look at that, maybe we probably need to talk offline about that.
Well, Representative Lewis, we solved the nuisance beaver issue here a few years ago. Colonel Smith, proceed, please.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lastly, I have the opportunity to talk about ginseng. This is really a department issue that cuts across many divisions in the Department of Natural Resources, and I'm fortunate enough to bring this forward. So this is ginseng is a species of special concern by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And what is ginseng? What's the value of ginseng? Why are we looking at charging people $1,000 to be a dealer and $100 to harvest? That looks crazy. Ginseng is, they call the people that hunt ginseng, they call them diggers or rooters. And what they do is, ginseng's a plant, but the plant really doesn't have the value. It's the root in the root system. And the roots, once they're dried, are sold mostly overseas. They use them for medical things. Pepsi one time, I don't know if you ever saw Pepsi with ginseng. They put ginseng in Pepsi for a while. It's supposed to be a very healthy thing. It's a market-driven commodity. It's not uncommon for ginseng to be about $300 a pound dried. And there is a large area of southeast Minnesota and southern Minnesota where people hunt ginseng. And because it's a species of special concern, Minnesota is one of only two states that allows the harvest of ginseng on state property. And so we did get some letters from the Fish and Wildlife Service. What are you doing to protect this species of special concern? So the group within the department got put together to talk about what are we doing. We really don't have a good idea of who's harvesting ginseng, how much they're harvesting, where it's going, whatnot. So a group was put together in our Ecological Water Resources Division to talk about what should the dealer license be, what should the digger's license be, based on having some type of management plan into the future to manage ginseng. So those were the dollar amounts that they came up with. There is, in the language, in the actual bill, there is the ability for someone who wants to just go out and get a little bit of ginseng to have a personal, a little bit of their own, so that, you know, if it's under a pound, it's not actually a pound, but
It's under a pound. They don't need to get a license. If they just wanted to go hunt a little ginseng for their own personal use, they wouldn't need the $100 license. But we're seeing people, we do weigh ginseng for export. We're seeing people come in with 3-4 pounds is the average. We'll see people come in with 10 pounds. So it sounds like a lot, $100, but when the return on what they're getting when they're hunting it is quite substantial. We worked a case with Wisconsin where there was $65,000 in restitution federally based on somebody that was illegally harvesting ginseng in Wisconsin, just spread across the river. So it is a business. There's a TV show on cable TV here not too long ago, Ginseng Hunters down in Tennessee. It's a very, very lucrative business for those people that choose to engage it as a business. So that's the ginseng proposal.
Colonel Smith, just a couple of things real quickly with regards to the ginseng. You say that the DNR on your slide, you say DNR needs to provide U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services with evidence and so forth. Can you get for me and the committee communications from U.S. Fish and Wildlife instructing you to do that? And my other question would be, rather than the state of Minnesota doing this, if the feds are so concerned about it, why don't they just regulate it and keep you and your officers that you're telling me are already stretched? What's the rationale behind it?
Mr. Chair, we've been doing this work for a while. I guess I could give you a better answer. Why are we doing this when we're already stretched? It's a state's right thing. You know, can the states, do we want the state to manage this species or do we want it just federally regulated? So I believe the hunters that I know would much rather have the state regulate them than the federal government.
So then to that point, Director Smith, when your COs are out doing a ginseng investigation, how do they key or code and what fund do they take their hours from?
Mr. Chair, right now it's quoted back to general fund.
Okay. And how many dollars have you quoted back to the general fund on the ginseng patrol?
Mr. Chair, I will get those numbers. I don't know that.
Thank you. Representative Clark, question.
Question, Mr. Chairman. So in terms of this issue of ginseng, you know, it could be depleted if it's totally harvested, right? Is there any effort to try to sustain it? And I'm thinking of, because it is a very valuable herb, medicinal herb, is there, like we protect our ducks and geese and fish, is there any efforts to try to make sure that that's not totally depleted and that there's some sort of sustainability at all?
Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the reason we're asking for the revenue in this is to actually have somebody that is kind of tracking that with our ecological water resources. Ginseng cannot be harvested on state parkland or scientific and natural areas. There's wildlife managers by permit only, and I believe Whitewater Wildlife Management Area is the only place it can be harvested. State forest land, you need a forest products permit from forestry in order to harvest it on there. But as to your point, making sure it's not depleted, the idea from our work group in the DNR was that this revenue would hopefully be generated so that we could have somebody concentrate on ginseng. And one of the concerns that our ecological water resources folks have and others is that because it is a lucrative trade and it takes many years for a ginseng plant to mature to the point that it's worth any value, that anecdotally we hear that ginseng dealers, when you go to sell your ginseng to a dealer, they'll give you a bunch of seeds and say, when you're out there, make sure you plant some seeds so we keep this going. The concern is from our staff is, okay, where are those seeds from?
Yeah.
Are they, are we introducing an invasive species? So there's some work that needs to be done around this issue. And this trade, and so that's why this proposal is being brought forward.
Representative Hansen.
Sounds like we need the ginseng czar, Mr. Chair. I know that's what you were thinking.
Director, I have one other question as far as collecting things. I have a friend, a constituent, who was ticketed for picking morels off of WMA. Can you enlighten me on what the rules are and how you go about getting a permit to pick morels on a WMA?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's illegal to pick morels on a WMA.
Is it illegal on state forest land?
On state forest land, it would be legal, I believe.
It is legal?
Legal, yes.
Okay.
I would have to double check. I was more concerned about ginseng than morels this morning, so I need to brush up.
Thank you. I apologize, members, for being tardy for my class today. I had a bill up, and we'll continue on. What day is today? Today's Tuesday. We'll continue tomorrow here, and we'll pick up with Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Leach, you'll be on deck tomorrow. And make sure, members, that you keep your little things in your save folder. And with that, we're adjourned.